Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory, which is a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien. On this episode, I'm going to be talking to Ermak Karadimir-Hazia from the Sociology Department of Oxford Brookes University in the UK about a book she's a co-author of called Enter Culture, Exit Arts, The Transformation of Cultural Hierarchies in European Newspaper Culture Sections from 1960 to 2010. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
This is an incredibly interesting book. It's unbelievably rich in terms of its detail and tells quite an important and profound story about stability and change in European culture over a 50-year period. And it'd be great to start off with a sense of how you did it and what the project was that underpinned it. Because as I say, it's a really kind of rich and detailed book, and it feels like there's been an incredible amount of research work that's gone into it.
Incredible amount of work. You're correct. Our book draws on a cross-national project titled Kudige, Cultural Distinctions, Generations and Change. It was funded by University of Helsinki, Kone Foundation, and Academy of Finland for the period between 2013 and 2017. Semi Purhonen, the PI of the project, Ria Heikkilä and Tina Lauraren are based in Finland. Carlos Fernandez is from Spain. And Yuka Gronov, emeritus professor of sociology, who is now retired, was based in Sweden and Finland at the time. I'm originally from Turkey, but I work in the UK. So we have quite a mobile and international team with a common interest in cultural classifications, evaluations, transformation of the cultural fields, etc. We all have conducted cross-sectional projects in our own national context before. And I believe that we all felt the need to look at the transformations we are interested in from a broader and longitudinal perspective. So this is how the research questions of the project have developed, I guess. This book is the most comprehensive output of our project, but various author combinations we have unpacked different aspects of our research in different journal articles. So yes, the book is the most comprehensive output, but if others are, if people are interested in various other dimensions that we discuss, they could just search us.
I mean, it's an incredibly fascinating data set. Obviously, you've gestured towards the importance of doing these longitudinal and cross-national comparisons. Much discussion of cultural change tends to either be very high level, if it's talking about Europe, say, as a whole, or tends to be based on one country. And it often doesn't have, I think, the kind of empirical detail that you've brought to the book. And before we start talking about themes and kind of topics and particularly the kind of theoretical contribution of the book, it'd be interesting to hear about the data set and the sense of what what the empirical basis for your discussion is?
The data set is, as we all know, the media as an institution, it plays a key role in how cultural classifications and hierarchies emerge and how they become legitimized. So cultural journalism is a significant institution. It attributes symbolic value to cultural forms by framing them as valuable enough to be showcased as art. It represents and contributes to the classifications of the time period they're published in. So we consider cultural journalism and media as an institution that could help us to understand the changes that are taking place in cultural classifications. So we look at newspapers from six different European countries, and we try to understand post-1960s cultural change by looking at the culture pages of these newspapers. So the newspapers come from six European countries. As I said, two of them are Nordic countries, Helsinki Sanomat from Finland and Dagens Nyheter from Sweden. Two of them are large Western European countries, Le Monde from France and The Guardian from the UK. Two of them are Mediterranean countries, ABC and El País from Spain and Milliyet from Turkey. So we collected samples of the cultural sections from these newspapers at 10-year intervals, including volumes from six different time points, 1960, 1970, 80, 90, 2000, and 2010. So we coded all the articles that are published in these newspapers between this time period. Our final sample included around 13,000 articles. So it's, as you said, it's a huge data set. And the coding process involved a team of 11 members speaking multiple languages and lasted through all of its stages about 1 year. We collected data from newspapers and we analyzed them quantitatively and qualitatively to understand the changes that are taking place in the cultural field.
The way to illustrate those changes, I think, is through a couple of stories that open the book. And they're the stories of deaths, John Lennon and Jean-Paul Sartre in the 1980s. And it'd be interesting if you could sort of tell me those stories, actually, in terms of thinking through what the big themes of shifting boundaries, the real kind of importance of time and place, which often sometimes gets kind of missed in discussions of cultural change. And then more detailed things about how the media actually functions in terms of format of reporting and the media's own struggles with things like commercialization. So yeah, Lennon and Sartre is a quite nice way to sort of tell the story of the book.
Yes, we think these two cases crystallize dimensions that are of great interest to sociologists of culture and cultural change in general. I also want to note that we didn't intentionally choose these dates. We had a systematic approach to data collection, and these two dates happened to take randomly was in our sample. And we noticed that all our newspapers covered Lennon's and Sartre's death in quite similar ways. And we thought that this coverage can help us to frame some of the issues we deal with in this book. For instance, immediately after his death, almost all cultural journalists in our sample described Lennon as a rock star, but also a serious artist or even a genius, comparable to Mozart or Hemingway. We think that this shows how the status of popular culture has been elevated to a level comparable with the highest arts. So we think that during that period, popular music was consolidating its status as art, and Lennon's case is a good example for that. In the meantime, Sartre, a serious philosopher, was being treated like a show business celebrity. For instance, 2 days after his death, I think it was Lamont, Lamont published long and serious essays about his philosophy and his importance abroad. But the prominent part of the coverage was for easier digestion. So they used several different layout techniques, which we think indicated a lightness in style. So we found like small humorous cartoons and small text boxes about massive sales numbers of his book. So he was introduced as if he was a popular figure. We think that this eliminates the ways in which traditional highbrow culture has become popularized in the same period. Also, Lenin, as you said, you know, concerns the boundaries and boundary crossings between art forms and genres, particularly because he was not only a rock star. He published books, including poems, short stories, drawings. He made films, performance art, and other collaborative projects. So we think that his identity, you know, his artistic persona that crosses these the boundaries between cultural forms and genres very nicely exemplifies some of the trends identified by cultural sociologists, such as you know, increased tolerance in the art world, loosening of cultural classifications, etc. What else? Lenin is also an international figure. So considering the international elements in his personal and professional life, and the impact his music had on people living all around the world makes him a perfect case to discuss cultural globalization. So we have a separate chapter engaging with the issue of cultural globalization. So Lenin case also speaks to that element as well. Commercialism, yes, Lenin's case also highlights the tension between commercialism and aesthetic quality, because Lenin was a millionaire and a former member of the most popular and commercially successful band of all time. So the newspaper's obituaries refer to this tension between his identity as an ambitious artist and as a popular entertainer. We also think that this resonates with the, you know, the conflictual relationship highlighted by cultural sociologists between, as you said, commercialism and popularity on the one hand, and aesthetic quality and, you know, artistic autonomy on the other hand. He also was a working class hero, a politically active, rebellious figure. This also exemplifies the role played by politics in artistic work. We have a chapter that looks at this tension between field of politics and culture. And also, as you mentioned, the reporting, the format of the art, the cultural journalism can be discussed via Lenin's case as well, because we found striking similarities in how these deaths were reported by different newspapers. Perhaps this was due to the role the news agencies that puts the news forward across different countries. You know, they start to operate simultaneously from with a central logic. And this directed us to explore the structure and change of the format and means of reporting about arts and culture. Yes, the coverage of Lenin and Sartre's deaths enabled us to introduce the key themes of our book, which are the processes of heterogenization, legitimization, popularization, globalization, commercialization, politicization, and packaging of culture. So they speak to each of these elements, we think.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I mean, there's so much to get into there, and we might kind of pick out a few of the isations for the discussion. And obviously, it's also nice to see the Beatles represented quite early on in the book. But from, again, you know, I keep coming back to this, in the context of a major bit of empirical work, because obviously, you know, something like a kind of broad cultural history would be comfortable starting with Lennon and Sartre, but then it might, you know, draw on one or two newspaper reports or, you know, a television program or album sleeve notes or something like this. Whereas you've got this incredible, as you say, you know, really extensive newspaper data set. And this allows you, I think, and this is one of the things that came through quite strongly in the book, to make quite detailed claims about how culture has changed. And one of the ways that this happens quite early in the book is with a discussion of music. And you've got a fairly, I guess, kind of familiar discussion about how sort of popular music, rock music, became legitimate, how classical music perhaps has been popularized. But you do this, and this is what I found most interesting, in the context of thinking about the format and the ways of writing that shape that. And it'd be interesting to hear that, you know, kind of detail about how particular formats and particular kind of modes of doing media and doing newspapers shape legitimacy and popularization.
Yes, as you suggest, it's we had a huge data set, and we were lucky enough to have skills, data analysis skills, to tackle with such a big amount of data. So we did qualitative and quantitative analysis. We not only showed the trends in how these areas were covered in terms of format in the newspapers, but we also look at the criteria used by the reviewers as they judge classical music and pop rock music. So our quantitative analysis showed that in terms of the format of the article and the criteria used to judge products, highbrow and popular cultural articles started to resemble each other. So we decided to dig deeper and read those articles. And that close reading revealed a twofold process. Like we see legitimization of popular culture and popularization of highbrow culture. So in earlier years, the reviews on pop rock much focus on the reactions of the audience and the technical mastery of the musicians. Whereas from 1990s onwards, there was a more serious and specialized writing style, mixing elements from both high art and popular evaluative criteria. We also noticed the diversification of article types in the 2000s. We see long reports and interviews about artists and musicians, which was important for legitimization of pop rock. So when you go and read the reviewers, the way reviewers review the pop rock supposedly popular cultural products, you see how similar they become to how classical music or theater or opera was reviewed, judged, and criticized. At the same time, we also find substantial classical music coverage become more heterogeneous and journalistically oriented in terms of format and style of writing. So we see increased article length, use of illustrations, new elements in the reviews such as person-centered focus, the best of the year lists for classical music, the star ratings, you know, the reviewers give stars to cultural classical music or opera, you know, that kind of high culture products. These are traditionally associated with popular culture and review of popular culture. But, you know, all these trends support our argument that traditional highbrow culture is being popularized and treated increasingly similar to popular culture in terms of, you know, the way it was covered by cultural journalists, especially in the later years in our data.
I mean, there's something going on as well with journalism itself. And later on in the book, you talk and you've kind of alluded to it, about the tensions within cultural journalism as it becomes quote unquote kind of commercial. And I mean, the French case is really instructive with Le Monde, because obviously I'm trying to think of the kind of best way to phrase this. You know, we have a perception of, say, French cinema, for example, as having a particular aesthetic position and, you know, a particular set of discourses around it. But even in that most, you know, perhaps kind of, you know, refined or rarefied form of commercial culture, cultural journalism itself has struggled with being commercial.
Sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Oh, I was just saying that cultural journalism struggling itself with becoming commercial, as you talk about in, I think it's the fifth chapter of the book.
Yes, yes, yes. There's a complicated relationship between money and funding, economy, and arts. And as you know, this is a theme discussed in cultural sociology. You know, how far, you know, how the role newspapers or cultural journalism in creating the distinction between the highbrow and the popular. But in the field of culture, the meta discourses, let's say, on cultural journalism foster the division between quality journalism and commercial journalism. So commercial journalism is argued to have a more like trivial tone, and simultaneously resulting in, you know, tabloidization to popularize the editorial content. And it's believed that in the end, this threatens what could be considered as real news. When we coded our reviews, we coded whether or not the reviews refer to the commercial characteristics of the production, such as its budget, selling price, circulation rates, etc. So we then looked quantitatively to see if we find commercialization trend. Out of all cultural domains covered, as you said, cinema was the only one that experienced profound commercialization between 1960 and 2010. And Le Monde was the only newspaper in which the commercial dimension grew notably over time. This finding is really, really very striking. In 1960, none of Le Monde's articles on film had a commercial dimension in the reviews. So none of the reviewers referred to the budget or its, you know, how many tickets there, you know, the box office results, etc. But in 2010, nearly 25% did. So it's a huge increase. And it's a significant finding, and it's really interesting to see how the evaluation or the criteria used to evaluate films changed in a cultural institution that is known to be that is known to have a very serious, you know, attitude to art and culture. But I also need to note that because we read the articles, we know how those commercial dimension is framed. So there is an increase in the commercial dimension, but popular movies usually get negative reviews. So there was a clear implicit expectation of a, you know, cultured, non-commercially oriented reader. So there is reference, increased reference to commercial aspects, but this doesn't mean that the articles that included commercial dimension made a positive evaluation of the cultural product under review.
I mean, this really prompts the question of kind of what's going on here. And towards the end of the book, you grapple with this question of, I guess, kind of cultural journalism in crisis. And it'd be interesting to hear a bit about that, actually, you know, the kind of sense of, is it still a gatekeeper to legitimize taste? You know, is even Le Monde cinema coverage, you know, if it's talking about box office numbers and stuff, is this a sign that cultural journalism is itself a popular medium and thus no longer legitimate?
It's a very difficult question. So we do look at if cultural journalism, you know, we engage with the debates over popularization of cultural journalism, and we look at the change that take place in the way culture was packaged. We see that the space given to culture expanded radically between 1960 and 2010. The proportion of reviews increased, the interviews, the space given to interviews grew, large articles took over space from small ones, and we see an increasing, you know, the habit of using visual elements in the reviews. The growth of illustrated articles is dramatic, so there's an obvious change in the way the culture was presented and presented to the reader. We also noticed that there's an increased willingness to address to a, you know, new kind of eclectic reader consumer. So the cultural journalists understood that they were addressing their reader wants to be updated about growing and differentiating you know, supply of cultural flows, global cultural elements, etc. There is a shift towards a new journalistic representational forms such as listings, star ratings, and visual elements. But I'm not sure if we could consider it as a crisis of cultural journalism, because from, you know, in the different chapters we find out that cultural journalism resists obvious commercialization, and they deal with political pressure, they still aim to cover traditional highbrow domains. We conclude by saying that you know, we think newspapers take on cultural trends and do their best to survive in a rapidly changing media landscape. And also, just a final note, we're looking at printed media, and perhaps other studies, maybe the next step should include new media and, you know, new ways of doing cultural journalism, and how that format represents the trends we are mentioning here.
I mean, it struck me that the real crisis was twofold, and we might take these in turn. The first thing was this question actually about things like working conditions, about entry to the occupation, about the kind of prospects of cultural journalism as a career, as an occupation, as a job. And then on the other hand, this social political crisis question. So it'd be good if we, as a way of, I guess, kind of concluding our discussion of the book, think about I guess, what's it like to be a cultural journalist? Is it sustainable? You know, is it a kind of a pleasant and rewarding job, or is it low paid, exploitative, etc.? Before we turn to these broader social political questions.
Yes, it's a difficult question to answer because our research was cross-national. So cultural journalism in these different national contexts had different problems, and their dynamics were very different. As you know, we have a chapter on politics and how it interacts with cultural journalism. And in that chapter, we look at Turkey and Spain as a case, because we think that they were quite different from the cultural journalism we observed in other cases with more established democracies. And I can speak for myself because I know the data on Turkey better than Spain. I can see how the dynamics of other fields, like what is going on in politics, in economy, how they affect the conditions in which cultural journalists operate, and how they choose which cultural products to present. We clearly see, at least in the Turkish case, the effect of military interventions, the effect of rising, you know, conservatism and political Islam, and how it affects, cultural journalists' capacity to critically engage with the cultural field. We have, I think it's, let me say, it's, we have a journal article, my other colleagues published a journal article on the fate of cultural journalism. So if you're interested in hearing more about the trends in cultural journalism and how, or what kind of trends or data indicate that specific journal article engaged with debates in detail.
I think a way to conclude is to give a sense from the book that you place a great importance on journalism itself as an occupation in a context where, you know, we're seeing journalists murdered under threat and I suppose in contrast maybe to a trend in media studies that's highlighted the negative role of journalism in terms of ideologies, etc. This book was quite nice, I might be wrong and read too much into it, but almost a kind of a defense of journalism and its role in the social.
Definitely. Don't treat cultural journalism with assuming, you know, any negative characteristics. But we see from the data how it changed, but also how established and strong it has been throughout the years, despite political pressures, despite commercialization, despite, you know, all the other trends going on in other fields. Cultural journalism tried to if you want to say, survive and continue to perform its critical role. And we know that journalists' positions were not ideal throughout the time we studied. We coded the gender of the journalist as well, and we are looking at how women, what kind of articles women were asked to review, and how it changed in time. So there are lots of dynamics we could unpack. But as a team, we treated and find out that cultural journalism has been a very strong and important institution affecting cultural classifications.
I mean, there's loads and loads of other things. We've really, you know, just scratched the surface of the book. There's a fantastic discussion about cultural globalization, although it's, you know, primarily a European book, there is a quite detailed and interesting engagement with the question of American culture as well. You know, as I say, there's so much else going on in the book. And given it's been so much work, and given how, you know, sort of wide-ranging and detailed the book is, it seems almost unfair to say, so what are you doing next? what's your next project?
What is our next project? So I know that the Finnish members of our team, they're working on a new project titled Dynamics. They're exploring cultural change in Finland by using several different data sets and time frames. They are following up on this theme. I'm doing my own research on a slightly different topic on food and feeding cultures in the UK, but with two other friends from Ankara, we have designed a new project which will look at how the rising conservatism as a political and cultural trend affect the appreciation and legitimation of arts in Turkey. So I will continue to look at the interaction between the political field and cultural field, especially in the context that are beyond Europe, because we don't know enough, but we know a lot about European cultural fields. So I want to continue to work on this topic by expanding this the sample a bit towards regions beyond Europe.